This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here with so many people returned from so many festivals. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
I didn't say return from the Emmys, but we talked about the Emmys already. We're done. We are fully all feet into Oscar season. The Toronto Film Festival is still ongoing, but Richard, as we record this, you are like hours away from having crossed the border. Like, do you even know which country you're in right now?
I'm still nauseous from a turbulent flight. That's how recent it was. So I was in Venice for 8 days, Toronto for six. So that's a full 2 weeks of film festival.
That is quite a lot. And I think you and David both toward the end of Toronto were kind of confessing that like it's a lot to take in. You know, you're trying to like really process all of these major movies all at once, but I'm not sure anyone really can.
Yeah, and the way the festival was scheduled, Toronto this year, it was just that Saturday and Sunday of the first weekend, which is normally busy no matter what. But like this year, it was just back-to-back huge things. You know, so you had to write in between and wait in these long lines because one screening was getting out while the other was supposed to be loading in. And it just felt really chaotic. And partly that was fun because there was a lot of excitement in the air, but it was also just like... compared to last year's basically empty Toronto, this was a kind of a culture shock back to pre-pandemic levels.
Yeah, David, did you feel like you got to properly take in what you saw? I mean, because I feel like the inside baseball is like, oh, the lines are so long and the food is terrible. But it does affect how the conversations around these films are shaped.
Definitely does. I think it sort of depends on the movie in question. It felt like a smart choice for me to start the festival with Triangle of Sadness because it was... kind of a fun, wild ride. And I was truly so exhausted from going back from Telluride to going to Toronto that I was unsure as to how I would get through the week. I think generally, if you see some of the reactions, there were some movies where it was like, oh my God, that is rooted in that kind of fatigue and that kind of just, especially in Toronto, you really are running all around seeing movies all day. And you don't have a gorgeous mountain backdrop like you do in Telluride. But, you know, I think I got everything that I wanted done, and I'd like to think I absorbed everything properly. On my last day, because I had a late afternoon flight, and I was like, do I want to do one more movie? And then I got an email about a last-minute P&I ad for Saint-Omer, which is a big French movie that played really well in Venice. And I thought, fine, I'll do it. And I sat in the theater, and I was like, why am I doing this to myself? And then I loved the movie, and I was very happy I did it, so... you know, you just got to push through.
Sometimes that last movie, you know, yeah. My last movie was Empire of Light, which I had heard sort of middling things about from Telluride. And then the first press screening happened in Toronto, people were really down on it. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I got to see it. It's a big Olivia Colman Oscar-y movie. And I loved it. And I was like weeping for the last 30 minutes, partly because I was tired and, you know, homesick and all that. But like that mood works well. So if you're going to go see Empire of Light in theaters in December, just like, I don't know, go on a long trip alone and have to do a lot of work on that trip and then see that movie.
And see 20 movies beforehand. That
right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Toronto had a lot of movies like Empire of Light and The Whale and Women Talking that had premiered at previous festivals and kind of had their buzz shift a little bit. But maybe we should start with the ones that really were the Toronto premieres. And I think the only place to start is The Fabelmans, the Spielberg movie that premiered in that packed Saturday night window. I think there were people shuffling out from Glass Onion as Spielberg was talking. It sounded like a whole lot of chaos. But David and Richard, you guys both saw it, and it seemed to have played really well.
Yeah, Richard, you went to the premiere, right?
I did, yes, which people were still filing in because Knives Out was right before it. And so Spielberg was talking on stage as people were trying to sit, and it just felt very... And then the movie starts, and it's a much quieter, sort of more contemplative mood than the one that preceded it. So I was really taken by it. It's, you know, it's about people who are not named Spielberg, but like it's about his family, and they're moving across the country to various places and the troubles with his mom. And I thought it was, I was really captivated by it. I didn't know a ton about Spielberg's biography. I know he's had a documentary made about him a few years ago, but like a lot of it was new information for me and kind of a new mode for him. You know, all of his sort of influences as a kid are plainly evident in his films, but this time he's like really turning directly to the camera and being like, okay, this is who I am. And with a sort of sad sigh, but also like a little clever wink, especially in the closing shot, which is kind of one for the ages. And I think all of that is best represented in Michelle Williams, whose performance is like really, really great, I think. Yeah. It's big, but it really works. And, you know, our kind of text conversation afterward was like, oh, she's definitely going to win Best Supporting Actress if they run her in supporting.
Which I think they will. I remember last year when West Side Story premiered, and we were talking about how, oh, Steven Spielberg has arrived and told us how a movie musical should be made. And watching The Fablemans, I sort of felt like in this sea of childhood cinematic memoirs that he showed how those should be made too a little bit with this movie, because it is so subjective and so rich in terms of the way he is communicating what movies mean to him and how they shaped his world and how they shape the way he sees his family. There are some sequences of the way he films Michelle Williams and of the way the character based on him sees his mother that so beautifully illustrate the specific power of filmmaking to him and the kind of statement he wants to say to make with this movie. I was incredibly moved by all of that and all of the choices he made. A lot of, you know, vague tweets about the last shot were made the night of the premiere, and I couldn't go because I had to go to the Knives Out party, the Glass Onion party, Ooh. Which was co-hosted by Vanity Fair. But I did see it the next morning, kind of having that in my mind, and I got... You know, it's a kind of a whimsical final shot, but it's also really emotional, and it really just hit me in the heart. I was pretty blown away by it. I think it's not going to be for everyone because it is a sentimental movie for sure, but I do think it works pretty thoroughly.
But I'm told maybe not as sentimental as the trailer that came out after the TIFF premiere makes it seem, which kind of leaned hard on the, like, a boy learns to express himself by playing with his Super 8 camera and the dreams of celluloid. Like, it seems trickier than that.
It is. I mean, it's darker, you know, and something that I mentioned in the review is that, like, you know, we tend to think of Spielberg as, oh, he's a nostalgic filmmaker. He's a sentimental filmmaker. And he is those things. But his movies are also dark and violent, you know, very often. And I think there's not violence in the movie exactly. I mean, he gets beat up at school. But like, I think the darkness is sort of well explained in the movie that, like, his first kind of... The first film image that really burrowed into his brain, not in a positive way in the beginning, was like a train crash where someone, you know, someone in a car gets hit by a train and dies. And he seeks to recreate that with a train set at home and a camera borrowed from his dad. And I thought that kind of explication was really interesting alongside the sort of why do so many Spielberg movies feature like boyhood wonder? You know, we get that too. But I don't know. I think it was a full and sort of honest autobiography. I mean, I'm sure stuff has been omitted or edited or, you know, changed, but like it felt thorough to me in a way that went past expectation, you know, and certainly past what the trailer suggests the movie is.
And felt really true. I think when you watch a movie like Belfast, which I wasn't as big of a fan of, there's a lot of that sort of those rose-colored lenses and these very sentimental sequences. And the boy is this sort of like unrelentingly charming young fella. Whereas here, my favorite sequence of the movie is probably, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but it is, I think, a moment when he realizes his own power as a filmmaker, and it involves, you know, him just shooting home movies with his parents. And there's a discovery that he makes in there that is kind of staggering for him and in turn for you watching it. And it's really quiet. It's just him watching what he made, but it's really powerful because there is some darkness in that. And there is some understanding of, oh, I can look at things in a more complex and dark way with this camera than maybe I can without it.
And so it gets me the clear that Michelle Williams is like the supporting actress, like front runner with a bullet, and you will have plenty of time to talk about that. How seriously should we be talking about the idea that like Steven Spielberg, I think underrated by the Oscars, but not everyone agrees with me. Like, is this his like big old third best picture win?
If there was a best picture at Toronto, it was that, I think.
Okay. I mean, there is the People's Choice Award, which we'll know the winner of by next week.
Yeah, which I would kind of think, oh, it'll go to Glass Onion. But, you know, the voters in Toronto, the viewers, you know, they do generally try to also get something that feels more serious in there, you know, like even if it's something with the tone of Green Book, say. But like, so I don't know, maybe the Fablemans would be that. But I think that because it is, yes, a tribute to a love of cinema, and that's an Academy favorite. But it's not heavy-handed in that, and it's kind of very particular in that. It's personal. It's not just some sort of broad, like, aren't movies great sort of thing. So, and the craft is incredible. The cast, other than Williams, is great. This kid, Gabriel LaBelle, I think his name is, who plays Sam Fableman, the Spielberg stand-in, is excellent, like, really a find. And he looks a lot like...
And he's, like, 19. Like, he's not, like, a cute kid.
Oh, he's a precocious teenager who seems older than his years and is very, you know, narrowly focused on movie making for a while, at least in the movie. And I think that the component parts are good enough that it's a movie that I think could stand alone even if you didn't know who Steven Spielberg is. So I think that helps its best picture chances.
Yeah, completely agree with everything that...
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Well, I feel like we weren't really long on Fablemans, which makes sense because, again, it seems like the movie. But, I mean, we should just go a little bit back to Glass Onion, which premiered right before Fablemans and I think was probably the other most anticipated movie of the festival. And, again, like, really seemed to have lived up to its expectations. Richard, I think you were one of, not the only person saying it wasn't quite as good as the original, but it seemed like you still had a pretty great time.
Oh, yeah. It's fun. And Rian Johnson, you know, does... He's very like au courant, like his references, his jokes are like very sourced from discourse that was happening the morning you saw the movie, you know, like it's and that can be an asset. It can also, I think, in Glass Onion be a slight detriment because a colleague said to me right after, it was like, he was like, it was Twitter, the movie, you know, like,
oh boy.
So I found that to be less rewarding than others seem to. I also think that it has the sort of sequel problem of it just is like, okay, how do we, Netflix gave me all this money. The first one was such a kind of out of nowhere smash hit. how do I recreate that in another intricate way? I think I have to go bigger. And the scale of the movie, even though it was a COVID production and the sort of what's being talked about in the film, felt maybe a little too big for what I would prefer, just kind of be like a creepy old house murder mystery.
All right, but David, can we talk about Janelle Monáe?
We can talk all day about Janelle Monáe. Probably the first third of the movie, I was like, ooh, I don't know about this. There are a lot of questions about plausibility, and I think there's some awareness that Ryan is toying with you and you don't know how, but the movie does have, I think, a really canny structural shift that opens the whole thing up and really just allows Janelle Monáe to run away with the thing. Again, no spoilers. Ryan is very, very conscious of spoilers.
I really don't want, like, I don't usually care about spoilers, but this is one that I feel very happy
with
being
on. Yeah, I think that yeah, we want to honor that. And so I don't want to say too much, but it's definitely a movie that reveals whose movie it is by what the twists are. So I should probably leave it at that. But I am of the opinion that Janelle Monáe is a generally very underrated actress. She was one of my favorite performances in Moonlight. I thought she was the breakout of Hidden Figures and should have been the nominee from that movie. I think she's always or often better than the movie she's in. I thought she was very good in a very bad movie in Antebellum. And it is a pleasure here to see a director recognize what a fun actor she is and also how much range she has and completely lean into that and let her loose a little bit. And she gets a hell of a final scene, too.
Yeah. And I also thought Kate Hudson was really fun in it. She doesn't do many movies these days, you know. And I'm also really grateful to her and Rian Johnson that they gave me a reason to yet again mention how good she is in Something Borrowed, which I think should have been an Oscar-nominated performance. It's a very similar role where she's this kind of vapid but cruel socialite fashion person, and she's just so good at that kind of role. And it was just really fun to... I kind of expected her to be like in two scenes and then die or disappear or whatever, because I was like, Kate Hudson doesn't really do movies, but she's a big role. You know, everyone gets their chance to do something fun, and I was happy about that.
I feel like anyone who traveled to Italy for that production, like in, you know, 2020 or whatever, like, if they're there, they're there. Like, no one's flying back home.
Well...
Oh, well, all right. Okay. All right. No spoilers.
Maybe that's a throw. Maybe that's a red herring. Who knows?
That's true. It does seem like if you want to get your hopes up for Oscars for Glass Onion, particularly for actors, that Janelle Monáe might be a reasonable place to pin them. I mean, we can talk about Netflix and their strategy and what else they have, but it does seem like the enthusiasm, you know, Knives Out got into a screenplay nomination. It seems like there's reason to believe it might go further this time.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. Coming out of Telluride, the mood was very dark and grim, and I think there was a real hungering for crowd pleasers, and Toronto just kind of kept hitting, you know, movie after movie with that. Like, The Woman King played really well, and Bros played really well, and absolutely Glass Onion played really, really well. Now that the race doesn't feel like it's lacking for that type of movie, and we haven't even gotten to Wakanda Forever or Avatar yet, I wonder if it's got enough weight and substance to push through, because, you know, this race does fill out quicker than we think. But I think it's actually a near lock to hit adapted screenplay again, because that is one of the most obvious places where it pops. And that is actually quite a thin category right now. So I'd be pretty shocked if it didn't make it in there. And yeah, in terms of acting plays, I think Janelle is the safest push. Unfortunately, that is also the most competitive acting category right now.
Yeah, we just talked about how Michelle Williams has it locked up.
Yeah.
Rebecca, I've gotten to ask all my Burning Toronto questions. Now it's your turn. What do you want to know about?
I'm curious how The Woman King played there, because, you know, I have seen it and I think it's a great film, but it's quite commercial. So I'm curious what you guys thought of it on the ground over there.
I was at the premiere and it seemed to go very well, you know, lots of cheers and all that stuff. And I think something that I really like about that movie is that Gina Prince-Bythewood, who directed it, she really just leans into the old-fashionedness of it. You know, it's like this big sword and sandal epic, and then also has this really exciting modern invention in that it's about people and places that we have never seen in those kind of movies before. So I think it balances its modernity and its sort of gesturing back to older Hollywood very shrewdly, and it's very entertaining. In some ways, I kind of wish it was more. I wish it was longer. I wish characters were further developed, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the kind of quibble I had with the movie. But, like, you know, Viola Davis is great. Tussauds M'Bedu is incredible in it. Lashana Lynch, Sheila Atin, like, it's just, there's a really great cast, and people seemed excited about it. I think the problem for The Woman King in terms of its profile at Toronto was that it premiered on Friday night, everyone was abuzz, and then Saturday was just like, here's Spielberg, here's Glass Onion. Like, it was, you know, there was no time for that movie really to, like, sit and be processed. But I definitely think that we can't overlook it for a potential People's Choice.
I wish it was longer is not a phrase I think or hear very often, so I will...
Especially after these 2 weeks.
Yeah. I'm not saying Bardo length, but...
You know. No, I know what you mean. And I think that is the movie's weakness in terms of its awards chances, because script-wise, it does hit some soapy, perhaps slightly more cliched beats than what the Academy would typically go for. There's a romantic subplot that I don't think really works, and that I think puts it into a different kind of category of movie than when it is otherwise. And the fact that it's also being released, well, we're recording Wednesday.
Tomorrow, as you listen to this.
Yes, tomorrow, is also not going to go in its favor, I think, because to Richard's point, it was kind of the talk of the beginning of TIFF. It was not the talk of TIFF by the end of that weekend. Now it's going to come out. I really, really, really hope it does well. I am really pulling for this movie and others like Bros that are coming out soon to find a big audience because they deserve it. And judging by what was seen in Toronto, they certainly play well to a big crowd. But I think it's going to be a real challenge. I certainly think Viola will get a run in actress. It's kind of part she is. You haven't seen her in before. She nails it. And it's Viola Davis.
She's
not one to be counted out.
She's calling it her magnum opus. She gave, you know, the director, Prince Bythewood came out on stage at the premiere and gave her talk and introduced the cast and stuff. And then she was like, Viola. And then Viola gave a speech that was very rousing and in which she used that term again. And I think that sometimes the thing that really helps a campaign is if the actor really wants it. And I think, I'm not saying that in a cynical way. I just mean, like, I think Viola's like, I'm proud of this work and I want it to be recognized as a serious piece of work. And so she'll help push that along, I would think.
It's funny because you see that with Kate Blanchett too in Tar. It's like you have actors this season who really believe in their movies and are really getting them out there, which is nice to see because it definitely does not always happen that way with actors who already have Oscars.
Those two, Florence Pugh for Don't Worry Darling, you know.
Yeah, I mean, just love. She's everywhere.
I've never gotten over my experience seeing another Viola Davis crowd pleaser at TIFF, which was Widows, which played so well in The Room and then just sank like a stone when it came out. And I'm still angry about it. So I don't think that movie was harder to market for many reasons that The Woman King won't face. But I've been burned before, so we'll see how this goes.
No, and you got to be careful of that TIFF buzz, I think. It does have its limits. And this was one movie where I am taking it with a grain of salt. We'll see how it does this weekend. That's going to be a big test.
Well, I have another TIFF buzz question. This gets complicated because it goes back to Venice. But The Whale played at TIFF after playing very well at Venice. And Richard, you reviewed it and were really not a fan. And you were not the only one. You know, it had gotten this warm reception in Venice. I think Brendan Fraser, we had a listener write in that it's Fraser, not Fraser, like Fraser Crane. So I'm going to work on that.
Like Razor with an F.
There we go. Brendan Fraser has been really well received and really well received in Toronto as well. But I think the movie itself around him has been a little bit more of a challenge. Not inviting you, Richard, to just kind of rehash your review. But I'm assuming you're talking to other people who, like you, that movie did not sit well.
Yeah, I paid attention to when that movie was premiering in Toronto, just because I was very curious to see. Because what happens a lot of times with Venice, with Telluride, is in the journey from the canal or down the mountain, something happens. And well, I think it's partly that more people are at Toronto and it's a more accessible festival in a lot of like monetary ways, geographic ways. And so you get a hopefully more diverse kind of perspective on the movie. And yeah, the expected dents and dings that I thought that movie was going to suffer were certainly there, but I still think that it emerged intact and the Fraser campaign really did. He has a lot of love for him, you know, both within the industry, within that kind of community, and in terms of the viewers. And I think that kind of esteem goes so far. And I also think, like, okay, we're talking Colin Farrell, the Venice Award winner for Best Actor, who beat Fraser at Venice, you know. He's a contender, certainly. There are some other ones emerging, but, like, Fraser is still, like, I think a couple laps ahead. And I don't know who is going to catch up and when they'll do that, you know.
Yeah, I haven't seen The Whale yet, but it reminds me a little bit of Renee and Judy, because it just feels like this is about the person and giving them sort of the accolades they deserved, especially for a difficult journey in the business. So I'm curious to see it. But to me, it feels like it may not even matter that much that the film is not well liked by some people.
Yeah, he just feels so far ahead to me at this point in that race. I think you could see Colin Farrell winning a lot of critics awards, for example, and seeing that kind of split. The movie played really, you know, in Venice, it felt like the reviews overall were a little bit more positive. But in Toronto, when it was at the premiere, I wasn't there because I've seen the movie, but I heard it played, you know, everyone was crying by the end and everyone was saying audience award winner. And then the critics were, I think, a lot overall harsher on it. You know, I saw critics from Vulture and Entertainment Weekly really reacting quite negatively to it. And I think that that's going to be a theme as we get closer to the movie's release is, you know, is this movie not landing with critics enough to actually be a problem for him? But, you know, on the other hand, you have the audience side where there seems to be a lot of love for the whole movie. I'm gonna pivot and talk about Best Picture a little bit, because I was talking with a friend who I think, you know, is very good at the prediction game. And he asked me on the ground, what are the, you know, movies that I think out of these festivals came into, you know, have emerged as like strong Best Picture nominee, having strong Best Picture nominee chances. And I mentioned Women Talking, Banshees of Inisherin, Empire of Light, Tar, and Fablemans. And then he said, oh, and The Whale, right? And I that kind of shocked me, because I just wasn't considering it in that context. But he had been in that room and seemed fully convinced that it is going to play enough to that kind of wing of the Academy to get into the 10. So we're thinking about.
I was noticing that I think it was on Sunday night as The Whale was premiering. They also had the TIFF Gala Awards, which is really interesting. It's kind of crazy to me that they have an award show in the middle of a festival where, like, no one has time for anything. Much
Both him
an
and Harry
show.
Styles had to run back and forth to their premieres.
They did. And there was a picture that A24, of course, tweeted, because they are behind both movies, of Brendan Fraser and Michelle Yeoh, who was there basically just to receive an award. I don't think it was for Everything Everywhere All at Once. It was like a Share Her Journey award. Anyway, a tribute award for Michelle Yeoh is very pointed at this point in the season. And so A24 seems to know what their horses are, The Whale and Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's not a bad position to be in.
No. I mean, those are two very strong contenders in Brendan Fraser and Michelle Yeoh.
I wanted to ask about the other Harry Styles movie. My Policeman premiered there. I did a first look on it and I've seen it, but I'm curious what Richard and David felt about it.
I think it's dead on arrival.
Ooh.
Ouch.
Sorry, I just fell asleep when you mentioned My Policeman. What are we talking about?
I think Richard Lawson killed it on its way to its arrival, actually. Wow.
Yeah, I didn't care for it. I reviewed it conscious of, I don't know if you guys know, but Harry Styles has a lot of fans online who are very,
You've
very invested.
You've tangled with them many times before. Yeah.
So I, you know, I didn't pull punches just to make them happy, but like, there's an earnest effort in there, you know. And I think the sad thing is you kind of just see him drowning, and like the movie is kind of powerless to like help him or doesn't bother to, you know. He's just like, it's just it's so much of the movie hangs on him, way more than I thought would. And he's just not up to the task. That aside, I also think it's just kind of a stodgy movie that, like, isn't really... It's the kind of movie that got people complaining about, like, depressing period gay dramas in the first place, you know? There didn't really feel like it had a raison d'etre beyond just, like, making people sad and then, like, Harry Styles being in it. And I tried to go in, you know, with sort of a charitable, open-minded view, which I do for everything. But this movie confirmed a lot of, you know, kind of early suspicions I had about it.
It's so interesting because I thought it was fine. I mean, I definitely agree with a lot of what you're saying. I thought Harry was better in this than in Don't Worry, Darling. And to me, it felt like if he is given some more opportunity, I do think there is maybe a chance for him as an actor. But maybe I just had a different experience seeing it alone in a room several months ago. But
he's been a little bit quiet on these press tours at the festivals, you know? Like, he's been there, but, like, when asked a question, his answers are pretty simple. But, like, he does, you know, I've seen videos of him at concerts. Like, you know, he does have, like, a funny side to him, you know? Mm-hmm. And I kind of was, you know, watching Bros, and I was thinking, like, maybe he'd be good in, like, kind of a rambling sort of comedy like that, you know? Like, where he doesn't have to do this heavy lifting. He can kind of, you know, further get his feet wet with, like, just, like, hitting your mark and saying your lines and, you know, maintaining the same energy throughout a scene. Because there was a thing about My Policeman where I was like, I was saying to a friend afterward, I was like, I wonder what, like, sequence they shot in. Because there are some scenes where he yes. seems a lot more comfortable, and then others were, and it's like, was that toward the end of production? Like, you know, like, he's learning. And I, you know, I think he's fine in Don't Worry, Darling. I think the problem with Policeman is just that, like, it's a heavy role and in a heavy movie, and he's not up to the task yet. I mean, that's true of a lot of young actors, you know. He's just been tossed into the deep end of the pool pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I'm feeling a little bitchy, and I'm not thinking about giving Harry Styles more chances right now. I got to tell
you. Ooh, your festival burnout is really showing you.
I think this one, it was just like, you know, David Dawson, who plays his lover in the movie, I thought was really wonderful. The movie and the story underserves him. I thought that was true of the book as well. So I don't think that's the movie's problem. But, you know, it's just like, that was a real actor doing interesting, deeper things that it just felt like Harry couldn't go to for me. The notion of him playing conflicted in this movie was just sort of staring into space. And that was my takeaway. Sorry, I really... I'm going to stop now. This movie did not work for
Harry
me.
Harry Styles is going to spit on you, David.
Is it possible this is the best thing that could happen for Harry Styles, though? Like, to have A Star Is Born, like, that's a lot for anyone to shoulder. And Lady Gaga, like, had her stumbles in it. Like, he's made these movies. He's had his time in this intense spotlight. Like, he can come back and try again in a couple of years when things are less intense.
Yeah, and in My Policeman's case, like, it's a mess that no one's going to see. So, like, it's not like he's like, it's not glitter. You know, he's not having some, like, hugely high-profile
disaster.
But what
if it were, like, glitter? Yeah. Would it be
better? Well, he is in Don't Worry, Darling. I mean, people are going to see that.
But I think he's fine in that. You know, I mean, that's just me talking. But, like, and also, Glitter's not a bad movie. But,
I was going to challenge you on that. I'm glad you corrected.
You know, I just think, like, God, this must be also exhausting. And, like, he tried it. Maybe the bug will bite again in a couple of years, but like I didn't detect any urgency from him when he would do press conferences for either of these movies. So I think maybe it's already in his rear view.
That's exactly right. That was exactly my takeaway. And that's kind of what I meant about the campaign is probably dead, is he just seemed done. He really seemed done at that premiere. It was not Viola Davis at the Woman King premiere. Let's put it that way.
I don't feel like there were any, like, really huge high-profile stumbles. I don't think there was anything even on the level of Bardo at Venice coming out of Toronto. But is there anyone else you want to mention who, like, we had been talking about a few weeks ago as a big contender and now maybe not?
I have questions about the inspection, you know? Mm-hmm. That premiered on the first night of the festival, so a lot of people had just gotten into town, and it was a very buzzy premiere at a smaller theater. And there's a lot of good in there. You know, it's a first-time scripted feature from Elegance Bratton, the writer-director. It's based a lot on his life as a gay guy in the military in the early 2000s. Jeremy Pope, the lead performance, is strong. Gabrielle Union's strong. But I think it was made a quieter impact than maybe we on this podcast had been anticipating based on its placement at Toronto and New York. So I think that... I think that the movie has chances for maybe its two performances I mentioned, but otherwise it's not the big, like, breakout thing that maybe we were hoping it would be. But I don't know, maybe, yeah. David, you feel differently.
No, that is another movie where I just feel like the campaign is going to have a really hard time. And this is a case of a movie that I really liked overall. But it wasn't the breakout that I think A24 was hoping it could be. It's a quieter movie in some way, in a good way, quieter than I expected, because it's not trying to reach for those Moonlight level emotional heights all the time. And it's also quite funny at times. And it has a more lived in quality that I appreciated, but yeah, I think it's also going to have a really tough time as a theatrical release. I don't know that there's going to be a big audience for this movie, given how small of a movie it is. perhaps the rare one where, because of its kind of social hook, it could have a better life on streaming. I don't know. A couple of people actually said that to me who saw the movie and liked it. So I've been thinking about that. But I think it wasn't a flop by any means. But in terms of where it can go from here, that's a pretty big question mark.
It's good enough as like it's a really strong first feature, you know.
Totally.
Can't wait to see what Bratton does next. It probably should have been at an in-person Sundance rather than immediately getting swallowed up by the huge movies at Toronto. I'm eager. And I think Pope, like, it's good for him. It's great for Gabrielle Union. There's no loser there at all. It's just maybe not the phenomenon that maybe we'd kind of pinned it to be.
I do highly recommend anyone reading David's interview with Gabrielle Union the day after the premiere happened, because she was just so great and funny and thoughtful. And like, it seems like a really exciting moment in her career, regardless of where the film goes from here.
She is so good in the movie. She has two big scenes and she is just completely owns them.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, maybe to wrap it up and to go in the positive spin of this, is there anyone who has kind of had their status improve since we last talked last week? We talked about Brendan Fraser already. We'll show you they're getting her award. Rebecca, I think you mentioned Banshees of Inisherin momentarily. Like, it played at Toronto, too. Seems to have played well right after Colin Farrell won the Best Actor award. Who else really came out of TIFF looking good?
Yeah, watch out for Banshees, because I don't know anyone who doesn't love that movie. And It's both a crowd pleaser and really smart and sneakily deep and gets kind of dark, but in a way that is more accessible. I think that could have a very long, healthy life this award season, and Martin McDonagh could be a front runner in screenplay at the very least.
Yeah, and it's also Searchlight, and we know they know how to do this, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely. I think that the good thing about how Empire of Light played is I think they quite clearly see that Banshees is their strongest contender. You know, it was really widely acclaimed. And also, I think it is a sleeper for the Audience Award, just because people do really connect with Martin McDonagh's movies generally. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they've all been, you know, In Bruges is such a cult hit now.
Three Billboards
certainly had a great life. Exactly. So this is a movie that did really well in Venice, and that seemed to only build in Toronto. And then on the other hand, I think Women Talking cooled off a little bit. It's a movie that was destined for a great Telluride launch, and they nailed that. I expected it to meet a little bit more resistance in Toronto. I think people still are really high on the movie overall, but as a Best Picture frontrunner, I think you can safely say it's down from that tier now.
I wanted to point out a Searchlight movie real quick from what you said, David, that I don't think any of us have seen, but people love The Menu.
People love The Menu.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
I have not seen it.
I love Ralph Fiennes so much, and I'm so excited about it. So maybe I'm just putting a pin in that's worth watching.
I also am curious to see what happens with The Good Nurse, which premiered at TIFF. Mm. It's a Netflix film. It seemed to be kind of lower on their priorities, but I think it was received really well. It's Jessica Chastain, Eddie Redmayne. I believe Eddie's going to go supporting and Jessica lead. So, you know, it's two Oscar winners in a movie that I thought was quite well done and was totally interesting and fascinating to watch. And so I'm curious if that's going to get a little bit more of a boost coming out of the festival.
Yeah, I didn't see that one because they scheduled it at 9:45 at night. And I said, good night, nurse. not doing that. I guess there was technically a press screening the next morning. But I heard good things about it, too. I'm curious to see it. I think it's not at the top of Netflix's priority list, you know, but it does definitely sound interesting. I mean, there are other movies like the Laura Poitras film that won Venice that played really, really well at Toronto.
Yeah.
It's a documentary about Nan Golden and her fight to get like the Sackler names off of like various, you know, public art institutions.
And it's headed to the New York Film Festival, and Nan Golden designed the posters for this year's New York Film Festival, which are awesome. So
amazing.
I don't know what kind of marketing that is, but it's working on me.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably too arty or whatever to be like a best, like the rare documentary that gets a Best Picture nomination. I mean, when does that ever happen? But
I
like,
I think it's literally never happened.
Yeah. Maybe it can't, maybe it can't happen. I don't know. But I think that's one to keep an eye on, certainly. And one of the big titles that I was sad to have missed in addition to Saint Omer. Which
I think
David
at the very least, it'll be another year like Laura Poitras' Citizen Four, where there's just the one documentary that everyone just knows is going to win and everyone talks about, and it dominates it that way.
I think Triangle of Sadness got a real big boost at TIFF, too. You know, it was, I think, one of the first press screenings. The crazy lines, people getting shut out. The public screenings seemed to have gone over very well. You know, it was just kind of buzzy, 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 as much as it could be when there were all these other huge new films premiering, you know, just 2 days later. But that helped. And the last one I want to say is, like, I think Judd Hirsch, who's in basically one and a half scenes.
I'm glad you mentioned Judd Hirsch.
Is, like, so good that he got applause when he exited at the premiere. Like his scene was ending and the whole crowd started applauding. Like, it was really something. I've never seen that before. And, you know, he's great. It's a really pivotal kind of film defining scene. And so I wouldn't be surprised if he gets kind of the Beatrice Straight treatment and, you know, gets nominated for very little screen time.
That's awesome.
Think he is a huge contender for a nomination. And during the Canadian broadcast of the Emmys, there was a Fabelmans trailer and it was all Judd Hirsch. And it was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Cut to me looking up if Judd Hirsch is Canadian. Nope, he's from New York. Just, you know, if he got like the hometown hero treatment on Canadian Fabelmans ads.
I mean, he's so good in it. It was one of my favorite scenes, so I hope so.
Well, we'll be back next week to talk about all of this, maybe gather our thoughts, honestly, and figure out what the season ahead looks like. But in the meantime, all of Richard and David's amazing TIFF coverage is available for you. We had a whole live blog with little tidbits that didn't even make it into other articles, so I highly recommend scrolling back through the whole thing. Our portrait studio was gorgeous with photographer Sebastian Kim, so look at those. And follow us on Twitter. We're at HWD. I am at Katie Rich. And Richard?
I'm at Rylaz, and I just want to say, just to toot my own horn, there are 17 reviews from Venice and Toronto that you can read, in addition to Esther Zuckerman wrote some for us. So there's probably 20-ish reviews. And David, you wrote some, right? There's a whole feast of things to read and other coverage. So please do that, because it was a lot of work.
No one will hear from you for a week, because you'll be in your hyperbaric chamber sleeping.
Yeah.
And David, where are you?
I'm at David Canfield 97, and I wrote 2 reviews. With another one on the way for Saturday. Spoiler alert.
And Rebecca.
Beckham Ford, 0 reviews.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of the Don't Worry, Darling press tour goes to David Canfield.
There's a romantic subplot that I don't think really works.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.